Welcome to Season 2 of Assessment in Focus, the podcast from Inspira, where we invite our guests to share their insights on assessment transformation, innovation, and enhancement. And I'm delighted that this week's episode is Professor Chie Adachi, who is the Dean for Digital Education within the Faculty of Medicine and Dentistry, and the Interim Academic Director for the Centre of Excellence in AI in Education at Queen Mary University of London. And I'm particularly delighted because that's where I went to university. Chie provides strategic leadership both for the faculty and the AI Centre to advance the practice and paradigm of digital pedagogy and applying educational technologies such as AI into teaching and assessment at university. She holds the title of Principal Fellow of the Higher Education Academy and also serves as a Code Fellow at the University of London, the Centre for Online and Distance Education. Chie, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast this week.
And thank you very much for the invitation. Great to be here.
I'm going to go straight into my first question. What do you think we need to give particular focus to on assessment and why now?
Thank you. So it's a really good question, I think. One that is creating particular momentum, of course. But to answer this, I'd like to just ponder over what university really is. And of course, universities can mean many things and take its form for the individuals, but it's a place of becoming, finding your own like-minded people. It gives a ticket to jobs, task force into the market, and so forth and so forth. But it is actually what makes university a university is largely to do with how assessment is done. And it is one way that we legitimize certain knowledge to be a thing, you know, the skills, the knowledge and behaviors. It's how we assess through the standards that we set in articulating what good and bad might look like. And therefore, assessment is a real critical piece in enabling what university may be. And this is a sort of my background. My PhD was in sociolinguistics. And so the way people talk about things, the language really matters, and how we frame assessment really matters. And so this socio-technical view and sociolinguistic view of what assessment may be is critical. And of course, with the arrival of ChatGPT and GenAI, we have to really rethink about what assessment really is and how we secure assessment, how we assure learning, and how degree is conceptualized and framed for the people who are wanting and needing this. What university really means is sort of being contested, is to say the least. And so now is a time to really reframe and rethink and restart how we talk about assessment and how we do assessment. And so what we've discovered through this period, and this was already happening a lot with the transition to online through pandemic phase, but this lots of innovation work, lots of rethinking, lots of reframing can happen in a speed that is exponential and that is unexpected. And so really, we need to grapple with this now, or otherwise the meaning of university is at risk and never going to be the same. And so I think this is why. And then there are lots of great work that's happened over just the last few years, the publication that we see, but there's so much of confusion as well in the research. It's almost polarizing views of what assessment is and what AI is and its impact on assessments. And so now is the momentum to continue. And it's not an easy feat because it's a changing beast, evolving beast, And so, yeah, I think it's a good time to be really having this conversation actually.
So in terms of that focus of what we're going to do, would you say then that the main focus is on defining assessment, or is it defining what students perceive as assessment, or is it defining why we have assessment?
Yeah, great questions. And so I think what assessment is has always been the sort of in the back of the assurance of learning piece, that we need to certify certain qualifications for people, and there is a certain thresholds, standards to be met, and we need to be able to say that those people are the people who have achieved that learning outcomes and demonstrate those capabilities for that particular disciplinary area. But now it's the opportunity that we have to really redefine how that might manifest. What we must do, I think, is clear. We need to assure, but we need to also provide opportunities for learning through assessment and so forth and so forth. But how we might do this, it's still up to us as universities, as educators. And that is actually the designery work. That is the work of educators and universities. Students alone don't design assessments and define what assessment may mean, all standards and rubrics and assessment criteria. And so we need to sort of take this opportunity, but also responsibility, to have this dialogue and the process in which we involve people, stakeholders, to do this right. And so it's an evolving pace.
Do you think that the student use of generative AI, which, you know, we can try to quantify, we don't necessarily know, but do we think that the student use of it, which is relatively high, is because they didn't like the assessments that we provided for them, or because it was just easier to do it that way? I'm sure the answer is somewhere in between, but I wondered if you thought it was weighted to one of those two higher than the other.
So I think we know quite a lot, actually, as to how students are using Gen AI and how prevalent it is now. The HEPI, for example, their reports over the last 3 years shows incremental increase of the use of students using Gen AI for all sorts of purposes. But if we look at this institutionally, our Students' Union at Queen Mary did a big survey asking students how they use it, for what purposes, and it's 508 responses from students. And if you think of HEPI, I think it was about 1,000, so it's quite reasonable sample size, and also 15 qualitative interviews that they've done, and they actually went to those students with diverse learning needs and backgrounds, and so, you know, neurodivergent students and students with caring responsibilities and so forth. And what does that what that tells us is range of usage, and not just assessments, but also, of course, for things like career development, getting the CV improved, or getting the mock interview questions ready, or going to ChatGPT for the first conversation about their well-being and mental health support, for example. And so it's really beyond the learning and an assessment space. And I think that kind of exposure says a lot about the creative use of Gen AI by students. And so once you're exposed to the capabilities of what Gen AI can do, of course, our students are really, really intelligent beings, and so they start to experiment as to how they can use those really cutting edge and prevalent technologies for their learning and an assessment. And there's this argument of students becoming lazy, they are completely offloading their own learning to Gen AI, and they're not doing assessments with the integrity that we want them to show us. That original piece of writing, or claiming their own work. And if they have used Gen AI, have they declared that they used Gen AI and so forth? But I don't think it's because of the laziness or easy access to those technologies that they're using, Gen AI. They're actually, most of the time, experimenting those technologies to understand what they can do and use them to their benefit, which of course includes learning in an assessment. And we have to acknowledge that our students are increasingly a bit like us as educators and university academics, that they live a very busy, complex lives. And so when ChatGPT can do lots of things, getting stuff done type, they'll go to there. But the question is, are they critically engaging with this technology and to their benefit so that they can grow and learn and demonstrate to us that they have achieved certain outcomes at the university? That's a separate consideration, I think. So I don't know if I'm answering your questions in the right way, but range of things, I think.
You very much are. And I think this point about how we use it too in our lives, reflecting that of our students, is crucially important. My sort of last follow-up on this before I move on to a different topic is this going to have to cause a rethink in educators in deciding where they do need original writing from students? We for many years have had this as this hallowed turf of we must get the students to write their original thing, partly because there was no other way of doing it. Are we going to have to, in the same way that I think we're going to have to reconceptualize what is, assured, locked down, closed, however we want to describe it, when is the right time to use that? Are we also going to have to, in conjunction with that, redecide what absolutely requires the student's thoughts with nothing else intervening, considering what life and technology looks like?
Yeah. So I was going to come to this point about Gen AI or large language models being about texts, words. And you just talked about the writing as a dominant form of assessment, in effect. Mm. But I might just start here.
Yeah.
So as I say, I'm a social linguist, and that's my home discipline, and education was also. But this is the obsession that we as universities have about writing as a really strong form of explaining and demonstrating what knowledge looks like. And this is especially in Western academia. I'm a non-native speaker, and this is how you find all sorts of strange accents and flaws in my English. My first language is Japanese, and having done 2 first degrees at the university in Japan, and I've done my PhD at Edinburgh, and I had to really learn not just English as an instructional language to get by and interact with people and understand the literature and so forth, but I had to learn a different register, which is specific form of academic writing, because that's how my work was assessed. And this is actually the kind of strong capability that LLM, the large language models, can do. And so if we don't stop obsessing with what essays or written pieces of assessments look like, this is the area that students would go to for Gen AI to do the stuff, which is the writing exercise for them, because that's what Gen AI can do very, very well. What we need to shift our focus on is from writing as a skill set and the written pieces of assessment as the demonstration of knowledge, to think about how people can think, how people can relate, how people can make sense of this particular phenomena that they are grappling with. And then we as an institution to think about, what does that assessment look like? What does that learning opportunity of them, students, demonstrating that thinking process, the relationality that they can do with other people in the process and the world and to society look like? I think that's the real shift that we need to see. As I say, the Western academia has such an obsession with writing and written pieces of assessments. And that's not the only way to demonstrate knowledge. And it's hard because academia and academics' identities are wrapped around such a capability of being able to beautifully write, you know, but that doesn't mean so much anymore. What means more in this current climate is how you can think, how you can work with other people, how you can lead others, how you can grapple with uncertainties. That sort of much more human-centered skills is what people might frame as those kind of capabilities. And that's a really big paradigm shift, I think, to do in assessment. Yeah.
Massive. And as you know from my Code keynote last year, I completely agree with you on all of this. I think we have that obsession on summative closed book exams, on essays. I said in that keynote that I would have done better at almost every assessment I've ever taken had I been given the opportunity to do it as an oral assessment rather than a written assessment. And the bit I'll throw in, I mean, the listeners now know about the Code keynote, and actually there's a link to it, which I might put up, is that I gave up after my first year of my EdD because I can't consistently write in that academic format. It just doesn't suit me. It doesn't match how I've written as a lawyer previously and how I write naturally. But yeah, that is our obsession. I want to ask you about a different topic, which is what we need to do in the realm of feedback. And I also want to relate it to what you've just said, because feedback is increasingly important in the workplace and in our lives. And the ability to both give feedback and receive feedback, two very different skills. So with that lens in the background, in terms of assessment feedback, what do we need to do right now, and why is it now?
No, thank you. Again, really good question. And I think it's a good starting point to conceptualize what feedback is that is different from assessment, because often, especially when you even look at the NSS question, National Student Survey questions, assessment feedback come as a pair, and then people don't really interrogate to separate the two. But actually, of course, they're interlinked, but they're different entities and constructs that we need to carefully think about. And then here, there's lots of body of work about what feedback really is. And the one that I really like is Naomi Winston et al.'s, and you interviewed her for this podcast too. And their research about what feedback really is. And then they just published the work called Manifesto for Feedback in the Age of AI. And then one of the key elements that I take from a range of statements that they have as manifesto is this notion of relationality. It's a learning process. It's different from in assessment, in that assessment can be a crude instrument of that end point exam, for example, in articulating what students have achieved or not. But a feedback is a learning process that happens over a duration, a period of time that students go through in making sense and making relational interactivities with people. And so whether it be from the academics and the tutors and module organizers, or peer feedback that they are getting on their piece of work through the group work, these kind of relational aspect is really, really important for the feedback to be conceptualized. And I think, and if you look at the notion of assessment of learning and an assessment for learning argument, of course, it comes for the latter to really frame feedback, assessment for learning. So those opportunities where they can take this information and improve their performance and their work for the future. And then that becomes then lifelong learning cycle of the skill set and the mentality, I would like to add. And so it's a process. It's a longitudinal view. It's a relational aspect that I really appreciate to think about this feedback as an entity and a construct. And then in the age of AI, and this is one of the claims that Naomi and others make in that manifesto, when you think about Gen AI and when students are using Gen AI to craft an assessment piece, they tend to think the comments or the text or information that Gen AI are creating for students is feedback. But one of the claims that they make here is that's not feedback. Information is not feedback. Students need to be able to make relationship with the person or the Gen AI, make sense of it, but also improve and do something with that information, unless otherwise it's a nice data and nice information, but it's not a feedback. So I think we need to really highlight that narrative that students do something with that feedback or information. And then I think, in fact, Naomi talks about how a lot of feedback is not used, and affectionate term that she uses, a graveyard of feedback, that lots of those written feedback stored somewhere but not being even discovered, and then they keep dying. And so we want to fix that. And one of the things that we are doing towards that at my university is this a project to do with, and I'm sorry to talk about this tool, but
no, please do.
Another learning tech that facilitates that learning process. And because of the infrastructure, the data that we can see in the back end, we can see how much of that feedback that the educators provided being accessed and at least seen by students. And so that is the kind of technology that exists nowadays, and can we utilize that? And of course, you know, by students clicking and opening that feedback doesn't mean that they have done anything with it, of course, but there is an infrastructure that we can leverage to then have that dialogue about, now you've accessed it, and so can we put another step farther to demonstrate that you're how you're using this feedback to improve that future piece of work, which then becomes another set of step in the feedback process. And it's not easy to do, of course, if you think about subsequent modules to go on, or this is the end assessment in that particular module. That kind of sequencing and logistical aspect, of course, come into it. But in terms of pedagogical approach, I think there's a lot to be thought about in conceptualizing feedback as a learning process, and therefore we need to put those steps and infrastructures in the process to make sure that these kind of stage scaffolded approaches to assessment and feedback can happen.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, Naomi talked a lot about this in her episode of the podcast, and I saw her speak at Assessment HE in Manchester a few weeks ago, which we'll give away when we're recording this. And I know from my own practice of, I think I mentioned that keynote, that when I taught advocacy, the students would get my feedback immediately. And there was the difference between the ones who pored over it and the ones who in one scoop would pick it up from my desk and it would go into their bag, and I knew it would never see the light of day again. My follow-up question on this is, we constantly talk about how we can improve feedback and how we should improve feedback and what people need to do to improve feedback. So I'm not going to go down that road because I know it's a well-trodden one, but I'm going to ask this perhaps a little bit provocatively, which is, if our feedback was better, would students who are using AI when they shouldn't not use AI because they'd want the feedback to be about what they did and wrote, rather than thinking this is great feedback, but it's feedback to someone else, it's feedback to the machine? Or are they so intrinsically linked that actually that's not going to change it?
So is it about relationality?
Yeah.
Is it about how students know that this is from the machine or people?
Oh, no.
That makes a difference?
No, I'm saying that the feedback comes from the educator, and it was, you know, fully crafted by them. Educator who loves writing, they fully crafted their feedback. If the student then receives it on a piece of work which was mainly AI and shouldn't have been, are we going to see student regret at, hang on, I've got this great feedback that could have been great feedback on what I did? Would that perhaps drive students to, if that's what we wanted them to do, to write more themselves, to do more
really
themselves?
Interesting question. Yeah. I don't know how we might verify that. You know, not often educators go back and actually look at what students have done based on the feedback that they have done. But I think it's a really provocative question, as you say, to think about what the work of the quality work of educators might do that then influence what students can do with Gen AI. I think that's the angle that you're coming at. And then I think that's really clever. And then again, I'll go back to the notion of feedback as a learning, as a process, right? And so you want to be in a place as an educator, you want to be in a place where students know what you can give in that quality feedback space. And therefore the expectation is upfront, and you already build the narrative that we really value the quality of work, how they can think, what they have done in this assessment is demonstrated, and not have to wait and do the wrong thing first in getting the ChatGPT to do everything and understand that, oh, great feedback, and then I feel guilty and therefore I'm going to do better and the right thing into the future. I think we as an institution, as the educators, want to be doing that front work of how we value the transparency, academic integrity, the original work. And again, it's a dialogue, isn't it? That you need to have these kind of open dialogue and conversations with students about what we value in assessments. And therefore, you don't have to wait until the end to discover that.
I want to ask, we've talked a little bit about the potential for AI to undermine. I'm actually going to ask you the next question in a slightly different way. Where do you see the benefits of AI in assessment, if at all?
Oh, good question. Where do I see the benefit? So, I don't think technology alone has ever been good or bad. That's kind of me stepping back to kind of think about technology such as AI as a tool and as a phenomena. And when I think about this, I often think about this metaphor of getting burned. it's a bit interesting framing, but you know, imagine a parent telling their kids to be careful when water is boiling around the kettle. And because if you touch it, you get burnt. And so there is a sense of danger somewhere that is the boiling water. But actually, children don't just get burned if they don't touch it. And so there is a human mistake that actually causes the harm. You know, like humans need to do something with that danger or the technology to cause that harm. And so I often think of this metaphor. And then of course, that boiling water can create beautiful things, of course, like tea, you know? And so that danger can be both good and bad. And then I replace that boiling water as technology, Gen AI in this case. And so I think we do want to think about this kind of what can be potentially a binary framing of Gen AI, the risks and transformatively positive aspects, but come to the benefits question that you have. Mm-hmm. I think, and I'll come back to the equity and access question later, But because by and large, those technologies are very prevalent now, it's accessible, and you almost can't avoid interacting with Gen AI. Even within Google search, you find it. And even within Outlook and emails, you find some kind of AI agent offering support. And so with that kind of accessible landscape, people benefit from lots of productivity aspects. So getting things done and faster kind of narrative. And often when I read really long documents, I am getting Gen AI to summarize, even though there might be the executive summary somewhere. Is there something that is not captured in the executive summary that can tell me as a key insight, that kind of thing? And so I think the benefits are that by large, they are predominantly accessible technologies, and then the capabilities that they bring are much more intuitive to what humans we do, especially in education. Because in education, in higher education, there's a lot to do with reading and writing, as we said. So that's what Gen AI can do very well. And so in terms of benefit, there's a lot around that getting stuff done, the performativity, performance, productivity narrative, and then also the writing and reading aspects of the benefits. It's not completely related to the assessment argument, but because you asked me the benefits of the Gen AI, what does that look like? I think these are the two areas that people often go to initially.
And I think those two areas will percolate into assessment and, you know, learning, teaching, and assessment. What a trite comment I'm about to make. They're so obviously interlinked to people's lives. So yes, I don't think that's a refreshing answer, Chie, because it's actually one that isn't so necessarily so focused on assessment. It's actually looking at the broader use of it and the realistic use of it. I think take the summarizer document that we bemoan, or people have bemoaned the use of that. There only needs to be slight tweaks to it. I frequently read an executive summary and then use my AI tool of choice to ask it to summarize other things. What has it also said about X, Y, or Z that was not in the summary, if anything? And I see that as a, an extension of Control F. It's just a more intelligent Control F. So there are, I agree with those uses. And I think they will be part of, to take your first answer to the first question, this is not an easy problem for us to solve. There's lots of things we're going to have to consider. But in that space of...
Add something to this? So an example comes to my mind, and this is a sort of, nuanced, layered thinking that we must have when we think about productivity and efficiency narrative around the Gen AI. One proof of concept that we are entertaining at my university at the minute is this bot within VLE Moodle that we have. And one of the use cases that our colleagues, academics, wanted to see is students getting assistance with the bot AI agent within the VLE around assessment, of course. And then the first use case was giving information about the assessment brief, so the summary of what students need to do based on what's existing in assessment brief and in VLE, but of course around assessment criteria and rubric. And so this agent, AI agent, working with students to help them understand what that standards and assessments may look like. And then immediately we came to a conversation where actually that information is not always available, right, in VLE. Some modules don't actually have really clearly articulated assessment criteria or rubric or standards. So then what would that bot do in that moment? And then I actually said, this is a learning opportunity for both academics to think about why they don't have these standards in the first place, and then probably provide something, but also for students to have that dialogue with the bot. You know, okay, so the bot might say, the assessment criteria is missing here. What do you think you would be assessed against? And then get students to think about what that quality looks like in that particular assessment. And then might go down that conversation of, you might like to have this conversation with the educator before the assessment actually submission happens. And so, you know, the benefit is infinite if we design those technologies to be. I think with the danger, we can frame those things in so many different ways that then both encapsulates the risks. So assessment brief, not having the rubric, but also the opportunity of nudging towards that dialogue and interventions to be created. So do you know what I'm going with this?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It's the benefit, but also the risks that can come as a pair to progress that kind of work.
Yeah, completely agree. I think that would be an interesting experiment too for educators to perhaps use the bots to interrogate their work to see how much, is there a rubric? Is it really, really clear? A lot in conferences I've been to recently about the hidden rules of assessment that we perhaps don't know about, which are coming to the fore by what students are doing. This takes us to the point of change and change within institutions. What do you think is the real barrier to assessment change right now? Is it policy? Is it systems? Is it us? Is it a combination? What's stopping us from changing?
I think all of the above is the short answer. And then assessment has posed so many barriers as well as opportunities, enablers. But if I can just pick out the policy aspect, and this week, QAA just published a report called The Perfect Storm, AI Assessment and Sector Under Pressure. And it's a really interesting read. And I'm kind of drawing some of my ideas from that report if people are interested to read. But it's this idea of policy setting certain things to happen. So the principle type. And for example, in my institution, it's the RAG rating in assessments, you know, red, amber, green types of assessments. So that says our intention and explicit pedagogy of how we want students to engage with AI in assessment. That's all good. But the issue, one of the issues that this report and some of the recommendations from our students' report is that this inconsistent implementation that happens in practice. And so the RAG rating is not consistently applied so that students then get the follow-on effect of inconsistent experience in digesting those assessments tasks. And so in even in green, when students are told that they must use AI for the assessment, what is not happening sometimes is make sure even the students have total access to those GenAI tools to be able to do X, Y, and Z. And they lack the guidance around how they can use AI tools for that particular assessment. And so I think that's a real issue. It's a big issue, but it's a very difficult issue, again, to do this consistently across the institution. And when you think about my university, there are 33,000 universities and quite a number of programs with different types of experts, academics, researchers trying to do the assessments. And so to implement a policy like RAG rating in a way that is consistent, in a way that we send the same message and then actually execute so that they are enforceable, upheld policy, it's a real issue. And then I don't know how we solved this. And then I don't think we've ever had a period in the history of university, that kind of consistent implementation of anything is done really well. And we're just before the podcast started, we're talking about how schools and faculties have their own systems of doing the same thing in 200 different ways. And so, you know, there's a huge gap between the policy and principle to the implementation in practice on the ground with students. And so that is a real issue. And I don't know if anyone has got answer for that.
If anyone has answers, they're going to be very popular. But I'm going to give you my penultimate question, which actually gives you that power. Imagine you had the power to do this. You could pick one thing that we could stop doing today in the area of assessment, and you could say it and we'd all do it. What would that be?
So in the interest of time as well, I might just say,
yeah,
stop the obsession with writing as a demonstration of knowledge. we talked about it before.
Exactly. I was going to say, if there was the emoji button that I could use on this, you'd see lots of thumbs up for that. I want to take you to my final question, because I'm really, really interested in this. And as you know, because like you, you've listened to episodes of this podcast in this season, and I hope everyone listening and watching has done the same. And if not, here's a good reason, go watch some more. I've asked this question to everyone. If we meet, we will meet again in 5 years' time. When we meet again in 5 years' time, and hopefully before that too, so much qualification to one question. I'm sure the social linguist in you will be unpicking why I do that. But what would you hope has genuinely changed about assessment in 5 years' time, and what will it take to get us there?
Yeah, so it's a really important question. And I think 5 years is such a long way to go. And I think that question about where do you see yourself in 5 years' time at interviews of change, thinking how much can change have changed in the last 2-3 years. But that said, I like to see really one thing in essence, this idea of true radical collaboration is what I would like to see in the area of assessment in the simplest term. And then radical collaboration, one which allows us to grapple with uncertainty. And so we really lean hard for certainty and for things like assessment, which we said can be a crude instrument. We want certain level of certainty, but in the space now, and Jason Lodge, it talks about this notion of acute and chronic problems with assessment, but it's not something that we can solve very quickly. The wicked problem is another by Thomas Corbin et al. We need to find a way to sit comfortably, more comfortably with uncertainty. And that is hard for universities who have been a knowledge institution to provide certainty for the future, for the society. But radical collaboration that brings different types of views and people, students, industry members, academics, but also underpinned by this absolute ability to be able to sit comfortably and navigate uncertainty. If you can do that, a lot of our thinking in assessment can become future-focused capabilities and what we really want to see our society and people to be. It's a very philosophical way of framing it, but I think I dodged the question of thinking about 5 years' time, because uncertainty is the one that we have right now.
For sure. Chair, thank you very much for joining me today and for joining the audience. This has been a truly fascinating conversation. I'm so delighted we're on the same page in terms of the obsession with writing. And I tell you what, my 10-year-old loves listening to this podcast. I don't know why. It's very strange. I go past his bedroom door and I can hear it. And when he hears you talk about the obsession with writing, as someone who doesn't like writing, he is going to be your number one fan. So
it's not the only way. It's not the only way, is what we need to keep saying. And it's been a really wonderful conversation too. Thank you, Isha. I know you've got title somewhere that says evangelist, but I think you should also have conversationalist. You're a really good conversationalist. So thank you.
This is very, very, very kind of you. So I want to thank you. I also want to thank our listeners. And if you found this useful, please like, subscribe, share. If you can leave a review, please do. They always help. And I am very glad that you've listened to this episode and many others. Assessment in Focus is brought to you by Inspira, providing flexible assessment with integrity. I've been Ishan Kolhatkar, and I will see you next time.